Okay, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. Good to see people on a beautiful morning in Yerushalayim. Again, welcome to all those on Zoom as well. But obviously, we encourage as many people to come as possible. It's really great to see people live, too. And I'd like to start with thanks to our sponsor for the whole 2022 academic year, that the Shurim has sponsored for an Aliyah for the Neshamas of Brana Bas Bendit and Zelig Ben Kalman. We thank the anonymous donor for that donation, and Be'ezras Hashem, they should have an Aliyah for the Neshamas. We are still in the world of embryology, which we will continue today and next week. Oh, by the way, if you could turn off your phones. That's a good reminder, thank you. Please turn off your phones. Let me map out, hopefully, the next few weeks. This week and next week, we remain in the world of embryology. Then we're in the summer season. The summer season means a few things. Number one, we can expand into new areas that we've never looked at before, which I'm very much looking forward to, because I'll have a lot more time to research and prepare Shiurim over the summer. But I will be away for 2 or 3 weeks. I will give good notice when we work out when that will be. But most of the summer, I hope that I will be here through July, most of July and August, and we will have Shiurim as long as the OU decide that they're having Shiurim during the summer, which I think is usually through the summer. Okay. Last week and the week before, we looked at the issue of abortion. I just wanted to give you a postscript. I'm not going to read the whole thing through because we have a lot to do. Maybe if we have time at the end, which we never ever do, but we may do, I will get through this in a little bit more detail. But if you just look at the appendix at the back of the sheet, you'll see that I brought you something from Rav Lichtenstein, which I probably should have put on the earlier sheets, but we wouldn't have had time anyway to do everything. But I want you to just be aware of his analysis. And I just brought you the end of his essay. It was an essay in tradition, which is reproduced in Leaves of Faith. He takes a fairly firm view that abortion is homicide, is murder in many cases, even though there is technically no capital punishment for that. We talked about this. Of course, it depends on how developed the fetus is. We talked all about this. But maybe I'll just read you the last paragraph, because I think with Lichtenstein, a lot is to do with his methodology, the way he goes about Ipsak. So have a look here on the last paragraph. I'll just start with this, and it'll set the scene maybe for today. Despite this emphasis, I imagine that some may view the ideas presented overall excessively severe and inflexible. Hence my second concluding remark. Judged by the standard prevalent today in most of the world, at least the Western world, the halachic approach presented here appears rather stringent. This requires no apologies, and I think that's an important line to put. We don't have to apologize that we're not in line with all the liberal thinking of the world. But it's worth making clear, certainly to those who, in seeking a humane approach, are liable to adopt slavishly an overly liberal attitude in this area, that from the perspective of the fetus and those concerned with its welfare, liberality in this direction comes at the expense of humanity, insofar as the caution of the halacha is tied to its intimate concern for the values of kindness and mercy. It is not only the honor of God which obligates us, regardless of the cost, to avoid what is prohibited and to obey the commandments of the Holy One, blessed be He, that are expressed in this halacha. It is also the honor of man in halacha, the humane and ethical element which insists on the preservation of human dignity and concern for human welfare, that rises up in indignation against the torrent of abortions. If the halacha's course is sometimes onerous for certain families or for those responsible for them, and this fact should neither be denied nor ignored, let us remember, paraphrasing the famous words of Byron, that halacha loved not the parents less, but the child more. I always love reading Rav Lichtenstein's writing. It reminds me how much more literature I really need to read and how my writing is so primitive compared to his. I think it's important to remember that. We're trying to get the halacha right. We're trying to balance many different issues, and we can't be slavishly tied to one perspective or another. We have to kind of find that halachic middle ground that is authentic and yet sensitive. So let's talk about genetic modification. Now, this is not my area of expertise. by any means. I was very fortunate and honored to spend a Shabbos with Rav Gideon Weitzman recently. We were together in with Mizrahi. Rabbi Weitzman, of course, is one of the senior poskim and rabbis and lecturers for Pua. Machon Pua has some amazing resources on this, and he should really be giving this year, not me, but this is my slot, so that's what you've got. But nevertheless, it's a fascinating topic, and there are medical people here, I can see, maybe aware of many more of the subtleties than I am. But let's just start with something basic. For those who, like me, are not so biologically savvy, let me just start with the idea that we are made up of trillions of cells, that I think people know cell biology. In those cells, there is a nucleus which contains a number of chromosomes. The chromosomes are the building blocks for the genetic makeup of the person. There are 23 chromosomes times two. There are two pairs of 23. In a human cell, in a human nucleus, there's also mitochondrial DNA, which is separate, which I'm not getting into now. And each of those chromosomes is made up of many, many thousands of genes. A gene is just the name for a package of DNA bases, which basically code in the specific nature of the human being, that individual human being. 99% of our DNA as humans is identical, but that 1% makes a difference that makes us uniquely us. There are around 3 billion DNA bases in a standard human cell, and if you unravel them, which was always interesting to ask, of course, DNA is packed so tightly in a cell, there's around 2 meters of DNA in every human cell. Which means that if you actually unraveled all the DNA in your body right now, it would be around 10 billion miles long, which would get you across the solar system and back again. Indeed, if you just unraveled all the DNA of the bacteria on the planet, that itself would be around 640 billion light years long, which is mind-blowing that bacteria, which you can't even see, if you unraveled their DNA, you could go back and forth to the end of the universe 23 times just on the length of that DNA. So you're dealing with something here which is miraculous in the way that it's all put together. And we're going to look at a few different aspects of that. Specifically, something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where we look at the specific cell which has been fertilized, this little ovum, this little embryo, and we try and work out whether it has any genetic predispositions for, certainly if it has an actual abnormality, such as, let's say, Down syndrome or hemophilia of some kind, which is genetically passed on, and that can be diagnosed, and screened, something called pre-implantation genetic screening, which maybe goes one stage even further, which we'll talk about, which is, well, what happens if there's no abnormality? And we have to define abnormality as well, it's not so obvious, but there is a predisposition. This fetus has the BRCA gene, or it has something which will predispose it to some problem later in life, which may or may not happen. What action can we take now? Should we take now? Should we discard embryos? Are we allowed to discard embryos? How does that work? And then finally, which is actually what I'm going to start with, the issue of gene therapy. What if we can fix genes, not just discard embryos which have got the combinations we're looking to try and avoid, but what if we can actually get into genes, into the DNA, and clip bits of it out and replace them with normal or healthy DNA, which actually we can do now. There is a system called CRISPR. You get a little bit of an insight into the psychology and sense of humor of genetic microbiologists by what they call these things. There's something called Sherlock as well, by the way. But CRISPR stands for, if you're interested, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. Okay, please go to someone else for an explanation of what each of those words mean. Sherlock, by the way, stands for specific high sensitivity enzymatic reporter unlocking. Okay, there you are. Now you heard it here first. But the point is that CRISPR is a system which is now viable in order to clip, delete and replace, if you like, bits of the genome of the child. So let's start with this article from Science magazine just a couple of months ago, in March 2022. So biophysicist He Jiankou, who was notoriously jailed for having actually created a CRISPR baby about 3 years ago, so let's see here, served a 3-year sentence for creating the world's first genetically engineered babies, plural. He may be released from a Chinese prison this week, it says. Actually, he was released in early April. His largely secret use of the genome editor CRISPR to alter the DNA of human embryos and implant them into 2 women led to 3 births, sparking ethical outrage and fears for the baby's health, about which little is known, meaning what's with these babies now, nobody knows. It did not, however, bring an end to basic research on human embryo editing. The response to He's November 2018 announcement was severe and vibrant, says Fyodor Umov, who studies CRISPR-based genome editing at the University of California. For now, Umov sees no circumstance that would justify efforts to genetically modify babies. So in theory, there is no genetic modification of babies going on, as far as we're aware, or should be going on. But he strongly supports using CRISPR to fix disease-causing mutations after birth, without causing heritable changes to a human genome, we'll see what that means in a minute, and regrets that we have poured a jar of tar on gene editing. He thinks it's not going fast enough. If you go into the next paragraph, a study reported last week in which a research team working with surplus human embryos from IVF clinics showed how CRISPR could rid a newly fertilized egg of an extra copy of a chromosome, a problem that can lead to Down syndrome. Down syndrome is where there are 3 chromosomes in what should be a pair in one of the chromosomal pairs, and other medical conditions. Other groups are exploring how to introduce heritable genetic changes via human sperm or eggs. There are quite a lot of people pushing boundaries in that regard, and we'll talk about those boundaries as we go through the year. Maybe let's go to the next paragraph. The original concerns about designer babies centered on CRISPR's sloppiness. The DNA cutting enzyme that is one of its 2 components occasionally slices unintended spots. And even if the cut is on target, the cell's gene repair equipment may scramble adjacent DNA by inserting or deleting bases, possibly creating new harm. Indeed, a study of CRISPR-altered human embryos found 16% had these, quotes, unintended editing outcomes, which is a lovely euphemism for creating a person who was really not meant to be, the targeted DNA. Genetic screening of edited IVF embryos might not catch these errors, and he goes through and talks about some of the downsides. Let's just go to the bottom of the page. Researchers studying CRISPR in human embryos face obstacles beyond the science. In the United States, Congress forbids government funding of research with human embryos, forcing Egli, Mataliapov, and others to rely on foundations, academic institutions, or companies. Legislation also prevents the US FDA from even evaluating therapies that edit human embryos. Now, they've obviously thought this through, but putting the whole thing into the private sector seems to me to be have a danger to it as well, if you're not going to have any government regulation at all. The 3 years since he went to prison has seen glimmers of progress in inheritable human genome editing, but many scientists say the increased awareness of CRISPR's shortcomings has underscored the recklessness of transplanting edited embryos with the technology available today. An exception is the Russian geneticist Denis Rebikov. So the Russians are always keen to push boundaries. Okay, one of the few scientists after the He scandal to openly advocate implanting edited embryos into people. We've done a lot of validation experiments, and now we're confident that we can move on to real clinical use, Rebikov says. Lovell Batch speaks for most researchers when he says such confidence is unwarranted. Stick to lab work on embryo editing for now, he advises. People should do as much preclinical research as they can, and let's find out whether it's feasible. Okay, so I don't think there's any danger of producing monster human clones right now, but this is clearly being looked into and researched, and may indeed be an incredible tool to prevent a lot of heartache without having to abort, as in the way that we've been talking about babies when they're already fetuses, as we discussed in the last 2 weeks. I brought you a couple of pictures, which you might know more how to interpret these than I do, but these are all fertilized eggs before the editing, after the editing, and these are all embryos that could, in theory, if implanted, turn into human beings, and they're being produced, as it were, in the lab. Now, I brought you here a little diagram at the bottom which explains very basically the difference between localized, what they call somatic gene therapy, where they can actually do gene therapy and inject the genes directly into an organ, into the liver or into the kidney or into the lung or whatever it is, which is very localized and will not be passed on in a hereditary way. And that itself is a very active field of research and has less of these ethical dilemmas because you're not going to be producing new human beings with the same edited or modified DNA. However, in terms of germline gene therapy, what they can do in terms of this research, in terms of this technology, is that they will take an ovum which has been fertilized, and they will take out the nucleus and replace it with a genetically corrected nucleus, and then you have a new genetically modified baby, which will then have this genetically modified DNA, which it will pass on and on and on through future generations. And we need to look here at some of the ethical issues, some of the halakhic issues, and what I really want to give you today is an overview of the different voices with which classic hashgafic, not so much halakhic, because halakhically there's not such a big controversy here, but certainly hashgafically, when is it and when is it not okay to intervene in these kind of issues? Yes?
Where do they get the
nucleus
from?
Where do they get
the other nucleus to put into the other nucleus?
So that's a good question. So they can genetically modify another nucleus, and then, which is not from a zygote, as it were, and then put it into the actual fertilized egg, which will then produce a human being. Exactly how they produce the genetically modified other nucleus, I think they take a cell from another part of the body, and they take out that and put in another one. They do all sorts of stuff that I don't understand. Okay? But you can Google this, by the way. I tried and looked at quite a lot of articles, and at the point at which I said I'll stick to halacha. Nevertheless, I think we have enough information to be able to do what we can do. Let's have a look at some of the ethical issues. And like I said at the beginning of 2 weeks ago, the Chazon Ish points out that we're looking for sources on this. I told you the story about the young lady on the plane who was a bit lost for sources and she didn't know when she could and couldn't do things. That's because she was a Catholic theologian rather than in a Bet Midrash. We have sources, and these sources will help us answer these questions, like how can good and bad uses of gene therapy be distinguished? Who decides what's normal and what's a disability? To two adults with dwarfism, they may want to have a child with dwarfism as opposed to a child who is going to be a foot and a half taller than them. Is that a disability? Or is that just they happen to be a foot and a half shorter than everybody else, and if they want a baby like that, then that's fine? Or is that bringing into the world a baby with a disability? Well, interesting question. And what about the high cost? Does that make it only available to the wealthy, so you'll have the haves and the have-nots? Could gene therapy make society less accepting of people who are different? Again, a lot of this is science fiction. We're not in danger right now of creating a eugenic race of people, which is perfect. Should people be allowed to use this to enhance basic traits, height, intelligence, athletic ability? I want a child that can play the violin, therefore I'm going to try and find the genes that give good violin playing. I, as a violinist, I can tell you, I don't think it's about genes. It's about a lot of hard work and practicing 8 or 9 hours a day, and then you can kind of work with the genes that you've got. Should people be allowed to select male or female? I only want boys, I only want girls, I want one of each. And we'll see why that may be halakhically important. And is this just a step to human cloning, etc.? This issue of playing God, which is a line that theologians like to throw around on these, you know, radio interviews, it's not right to play God. Well, what does that even mean? We play God all the time every time we give somebody antibiotics. You know, if God wants you to get better, you'll get better. How do you draw that line? We definitely intervene. How do hubris and humility play out in radical technological developments? What's the status of a fertilized egg? We'll see in a minute a very clear tshuva on that. What is the role of religious leaders, etc.? So let's start with some sources which go beyond this issue, but which I think will be very informative. There is a debate, and one of the things that is so fascinating about halacha and hashgafa is that you have to go to unusual places to find it. It's not where you would expect it to be. There is a debate here in Masechet Yadayim. It's Masechet Yadayim. It deals with Netilat Yadayim. But this is a Mishnah in Masechet Yadayim that has actually got nothing to do with Netilat Yadayim. It's to do with what kind of maisa you have to give during the Shemitah year if you live in Ammon or Moab. You were thinking that's where I was going to start, right? Okay? Meaning that in Israel, there is no Maaseh in the Shemitah year, because the produce is Hefka, and therefore you don't have to take Trumot and Masrot. But Chazal introduced a rabbinic obligation on the countries around Israel, because they're so close to Eretz Israel. So if you live in Amon and Moab, which is now, you know, Jordan, you would have to give a Maaseh on a Derabbanan level. So during the Shemitah year, which is it going to be? They don't have Shemitah. So you should, in theory, still have to give a seventh year Maaseh. So the machlokas. One of you says, Rabbi Tarfon says you have to give Maaseh Ani, which is to the poor, even though you did that in the previous year, in the sixth year. And the other view, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, says you have to give Maaseh Sheni, which you have to then bring to Yerushalayim. So now we pick it up in number one. Amar Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael turns around in this debate and says, Elazar ben Azariah, who gives the stringent view of Maaseh Sheni, because there are a lot more restrictions. Alecha raya lilmod, or lelamed. You have to give, the proof is the onus is on you to teach. You have to prove your case. She'ata machmir. Because you're the one that is strict. She'kol ha-machmir alav raya lelamed. Anyone who wants to be strict in any question, the onus is on them to show why you should be strict. Not on the onus on people why you should be lenient. This is a fascinating hashkafic approach. And it's very specially explains, Shekol dava sheloi neida tam la'asroi. Anything where we don't know that it's prohibited, mutter, is permitted. The default position for all things in life is they are permitted, until the Torah comes and says that they're not. Mutter hu bli tam. I don't need to prove to you why it's permitted. It's automatically permitted unless you can prove the otherwise. The lo hizkira ha-Torah dvarim ha-mutarim kulam. The Torah doesn't tell you what you're allowed to do. Rak dvarim ha-asurim, only telling what you're not allowed to do or what you're obliged to do, but not what you're allowed to do. So that's an interesting starting point. So in principle, we should be permissive on these kind of issues. Unless there's a reason why it's asur, then it's mutter. That's the starting point. Secondly, generally on innovation, there are different approaches. I brought you two quotes which really have nothing to do directly with technology. One from the Chasam Sofer, one from Rav Kook, but they're more a worldview in Hashkafic issues too. And number two, look at the Chasam Sofer. This is the source of the very famous line from the Chasam Sofer. V'kach yafe lanu, shelo la'aved et Yisrael b'chadashos. We shouldn't be traumatizing the Jewish people with new things. Shaloi Sharu Avosenu, which our forefathers never dealt with. Umilasi Kfar Amura, you know my view on this, says the Chasam Sofer. Hachadash Asur Minatora B'chol Makom. Anything which is new is suspect. It shouldn't be okay if it's new. Now, again, he's not talking about technology. Indeed, the Chasam Sofer was one of the early advocates of the Shabbos timer. How did you have a Shabbos timer in Pressburg in the early 19th century? So they innovated a very, very slow, long fuse that you could light on Friday afternoon, which would burn very slowly through Friday night. I'm not sure about the fire hazard issues, but let's leave that aside. Okay? And then on Shabbos morning, early, 5 o'clock in the morning, whatever, it would hit the kindling, it would light the fire, and it would boil up your coffee. And they debated whether this was okay, whether it was done. The Chasam Sofer was very open to new technologies. He was talking really more hashkafically, but there is an underlying idea of a chadash asur min haTorah, certainly from certain areas. The Rav Kook, on the other hand, has another famous line, number three, hayashan yitchadesh v'hachadash yitchadesh. Okay? That which is old will be renewed, and that which was new will be sanctified. V'yachdav, and together yiyu la'avukos orim al tzion, and they will be light up the way, they will enlighten us. So Rav Kook had a much more open attitude towards that which was new. Again, this is not talking about technology. And it's not really fair to bring a one-liner from the Chasam Sofer and a one-liner from Rav Kook and say, this typifies their approach in life. You need to go much deeper. But there are different approaches on it. Yes, sir? This is in one of his letters. Yeah, this is Rav Kook's words. As far as I'm aware, I don't think he's quoting anybody else. Right, correct. Now, in terms of classic sources on technology, there are some strong interventionist sources. Look at number four. Says the Gemara in Bavar Basra. Turnus Rufus Arashes Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara sets up conversations between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. Now, whether these were conversations that actually happened in the Beis HaMedrash or outside in the street and were recorded, or whether the Gemara is setting up the classic Jewish versus the classic non-Jewish approach on these philosophical issues. So we have this conversation. Im Elokeichem Oyev Aniyim Hu. If your God loves poor people, says the Roman, Nipneima Einu Mefarasim. Why does he not give them money? Obviously, he wants them to be poor. So Amalei, so he said to him, God makes them poor so that we can give them starker and we can escape, you know, Gehenna, and we can get to Gan Eden. So Amalei says, really? That's your attitude? That's your argument? Adarab, on the contrary. You should go to Gehenna for giving people poverty, charity, to give tzedakah. I'm going to tell you a marshal, says Turnus Rufus. If there was a king who was angry with his servant, and he locks him up in prison, no one's allowed to give them food, no one's allowed to give them drink. They're a persona non grata. And then someone creeps in the prison and gives them food against the king's command. When the king hears, will he not be incensed? You're called the servants of God. And you're going behind God's back, as it were, and giving money to people that God says shouldn't have money. So how can you justify that? So Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva turns around and says, no. I'm going to give you a counter argument. If a king was angry at his own child, and locked them away, and he commands officially that he's not meant to be helped, and someone comes behind the king's back and helps his own son, he won't even be pleased, he'll send him a gift, etc. We're the children of God. And not just the Jewish people, by the way, are the children of God. All the world are the children of God, and the Jewish people are the Bechor. That's the marshal that's given in Shemot. And therefore, Rabbi Akiva says, you're not asking the right question. You're thinking like a cruel Roman, rather than with Rachmanis, like the Jewish people, that God wants us to intervene and gives us opportunities to intervene. And therefore, we are, in principle, interventionist. When people are needy, when people are poor, when people are sick, when people need help, we want to intervene. As long as there's no reason why we can't, then we should. Secondly, we believe that the world is something that needs tikkun on a more fundamental basis. Number five, philosoph echad sha'al et Rabbi Hoshaya. So a philosopher asked Rabbi Hoshaya, Amalei im chaviva hi hamila, if bris mila is so dear to God, why did Adam HaRishon not have one in the first place? Why did God create human beings imperfect? Amalei, so he said to him, by the way, this is a classic Christian idea, that God created the world perfect and human beings messed it up. This is not a Jewish idea. In the Christian understanding of Gan Eden was created perfect, and the sin, from a theological Christian perspective, was after the creation. From the Jewish perspective, if you remember, I didn't put on the sheet, the Medrash about the busy Friday of creation, the sixth day of creation when God created, you know, all the mammals and then man and da 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 da, and then, or rather man, and man was created, and then the sin happened on the sixth day of creation. Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz Hadas on the sixth day, and they were punished and thrown out of Gan Eden on the sixth day. Therefore, sin and the need to correct sin from a Jewish perspective is part of the natural process of creation. That's a very different perspective on sin and tshuva than the Christian perspective on sin and tshuva. This may be coming out here. Like, why would God create the world imperfect? That can't be. Human beings are messing up the world, not God. So Amalei, so he turned around to him and said, no, kol ma shenivra b'sheishis shimei b'reishis tzrichin asiyah. Everything that was created needs perfection. Everything. Everything is in that need of that little bit extra. Kagana chazal tzarech lintok. Mustard needs a little bit of sugar, or whatever it is. Haturmusim, beans, tzarech lintok, needs a little bit of sweetening. Hachitin tzrichim litachen. Wheat needs to be ground up. Afilo adam tzarech tikkun. Even man needs a tikkun. Nothing is complete. As my grandmother, I don't get to quote my grandmother much in a shir, but my grandmother used to often say, an egg is perfect, all it needs is a little bit of salt. Okay, take it or leave it. Cookery and culinary advice from my grandmother. But everything needs a little bit of something. So mankind, that tikkun olam, is fundamental to Judaism. Of course, if you're Kabbalistic, Tikkun Olam doesn't just mean Tikkun of this world. Tikkun Olam means we have to perfect all the cosmic worlds as well, and the perfection comes back down again, but I'm not going there right now. More down to earth, if you look in number 6, built into creation, V'yivarech otam Elohim, V'yom Elohim Elohim, Pru Uruvu. Go and create the world and create more human beings. Milu et ha'aretz v'kishua. Fill up the world and conquer it. What does it mean, fill up the world? So on a pshat level, it means just make more people and fill the world with people. But says the Ksav HaKabbalah, look at number 7. Loshen mil'uhu al hashlamat chisaron. Fill up means that it's a little bit empty. You have to fill it up to the top. Chisaron b'davar. V'hene Adam, this is a beautiful source here. Ha'adam shehaya ha'achron b'briya. Adam was the last creation. V'af shehaya motzeh ha'kol muchan nefan. Even though he found everything in the world prepared, kol meni d'shaim, all of the grains and the grasses, tfuot, perot, ha'ilan, all of the beautiful fruit of the world, mikol makam haya kasher alav li'anot behem, he couldn't really enjoy them, ki ha'chaser mikol meni kelim, because he didn't have the kelim to really enjoy them. He couldn't really get to the produce without developing technology. It's a very interesting perspective. Ulchein haita abrocha mimenu yisbarach. Therefore, God gave him a brocha letet lo dat, to give him the mind utfuna, the understanding to make these technologies lahamti laatzmo tachbulot asher ba'emtzuatam yochal lashlim kol chisronatav ha'ela. That God gave mankind, this was the bracha, milu et ha'aretz, develop technology. This is why you light a Havdalah candle, Motzei Shabbos. Why do you? It's nothing to do with Havdalah. Sometimes we have Havdalah without Eish, and sometimes we have Eish without Havdalah. Why are we lighting a Havdalah candle on Motzei Shabbos? This idea that this is now the beginning of my technological week, and I'm going to be manipulating and creating and developing new things in the world of technology that I can use in order to access this world. V'hinei al hashlamat chisronatav eile ama milu et ha'aretz. This is the bracha, fill up the world. Hishlimo, completed la'atzmeichem, for yourselves, l'dvarim ha'chaserim, things that are lacking right now, lachem bo'olam. Bracha zo hi gedolama odin. This is an amazing bracha. Of course, in Ksava Kabbalah, Rav Mecklenburg was living in the middle of the 19th century, in the age of great technological change. You think of what was happening in his own life through the 19th century when the human race was unlocking technology. This is an amazing bracha. Shuchu lahamsi lo kelim mikelim shonim. Which has a little bit of a negative overtone as well. Kelim mikelim shonim. From the Megillah, which is about the feast of Achashverosh. But you can create so many different means. Lahakel ba'etzmo'otam avodata. To alleviate all the toil. Again, think about someone in the 1870s compared to the 1770s. It's a different world. Then think of the 1970s after that. I maybe don't think of the 1970s too much. There are other things happening in the 1970s. Okay, fine. Amnan taiva hi zahi gedola mitzad gufo. This is great from a physical perspective, and not mitzad nafsho, but from a spiritual perspective, yesh bezet sadra. It's not all plain sailing. It's not just about unlocking the world. This is a physical brocha, but it has with it a negative spiritual side, which we'll see in a minute how that works. One of the issues we've talked about a lot, and I don't want to dwell on, is related. The boundaries of healing, number 8, says the Torah, when somebody is injured, rapport yirapé. They must be healed. You have to pay for the person who damaged them. Must pay. And the Gemara number 9, Debei Rabbi Yishmael Oimer, v'rapo yirapé, mikan shenitan rushut lofel rapot. There's a permission to do refuah. But you need permission to do refuah. Why? So Rashi says, because we don't say, v'loyam rinam rachmana machi iu masi, God made him sick, let God heal him. That we don't say, but it has to be refuah. And where are the lines of refuah? If a baby has a Down syndrome, if a fetus has Down syndrome, there's no question that it's refuah to somehow correct that Down syndrome, if that's possible. That would be refuah. But if a baby is going to grow up to a person who is a man who's only 5'2", is it refuah to engineer such a way that he can be 5'10"? Is that refuah? You know, if everyone who was 5'2" had never been 5'2", think of all those people with Napoleon syndrome that would have not changed the world in the way that they... Truth is, Napoleon was actually taller than people think, but that's not for now. Many people who were 5'2" overcame that and did amazing things. Have you really healed them by making them 5'10"? Have you really done got to be... That's very hard to classify as refuah. And according to this, if it's not refuah, maybe that's not allowed halachically. We may be interventionists, but there is a limit. Yes?
Isn't that the time about Beethoven being...
Being deaf. Well, I don't know. You know, was it Beethoven's deafness that resulted in his later symphonies? Or if Beethoven had been able to hear, would he have written another 5 symphonies? I don't know. You have to get into the psychology of Beethoven. You can certainly hear the frustration in the music, that's for sure. And the music would not have been as frustrated, one imagines, if Beethoven had been less frustrated. But that's we're already getting into the beyond the scope of the show. Although I'd like to talk about Beethoven more. Yes. Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, now, page 5. Let's talk about the boundaries of nature. 2 mitzvahs. So, what are the boundaries? There are halachic boundaries. Rapo yirapeh. You can't just do anything. So, the Sefer HaChinuch brings our attention to 2 mitzvahs. One is witchcraft, manipulating inappropriately the natural world. And one is kilayim, manipulating naturally but still inappropriately the natural world. So, let's have a look at these two. Says the HaChinuch, number 10. V'inyana kishuv, let's talk about witchcraft, he said. Hulefi dati kein, this is why witchcraft is a problem. Shehashem baruch hu, sam b'tchila habriya, b'tchilas habriya, God put into the creation, l'kol davar v'davar midivrei ha'olam, teva, put a certain nature into it. Lif'ol pulata, that's the way it works. L'pulata tova, v'yishara l'tovat b'nei ha'olam, and that's how it works right for the world. Asher bara, which God created. V'tziva kol echad lif'ol pa'alo l'mineihu, and everything has to work the way it works. But when you get into messing all that up and mixing all that up, there are boundaries. We can't just change the nature of creation to be an unnatural thing. That God knows that this will ultimately be very bad for us. That's why God says don't get involved in witchcraft. Because you're going to manipulate the world in unnatural ways, and you're not allowed to do that. The world, the way it works, the way it's meant to work. Now, of course, witchcraft is a whole debate. According to the Chinuch, it sounds like here, and also the Ramban, it's very interesting because the Chinuch usually follows the approach of the Ramban, of Maimonides. And here he doesn't seem to be. Because the Rambam's approach, as you probably know, is that witchcraft doesn't manipulate anything. Witchcraft is just complete foolishness, and the reason the Torah says you're not allowed to get involved in it is because it's foolish. And the Jews are meant to be the chachamim of the world, and if you get tricked into this nonsense, they're all charlatans, these people. It's all smoke and mirrors. This is the Ibn Ezra, by the way, also on Paro, and the things that they're doing in the palace, all smoke and mirrors. So the Rambam says, you're not manipulating anything. Okay, the Ramban, sounds like the Chinuch says, you are, maybe there is a dark side, don't get involved, because it's unnatural. Now, how far does that go? First of all, in number 11, on the issue of Darche Emori, which is infringing on this line, pinching on this line of what isn't natural and witchcraft, etc. Abai v'Ravadam, and Trevaihu, number 11, both of them say, Kol dav sheyesh bo mishum refuah, if you're actually trying to heal people, ein bo mishum Darche Emori. That's okay. Darche Emori is involving yourself in other superstitious, dark practices, etc. But if you're doing it in order to heal someone from a disease, then there are far less restrictions. That's okay. Right, putting a bird, it's a pigeon, on someone's stomach, and we talked about this, right? To take away Right. But apparently it works. So we'll see. Whatever. But that you can talk to the good doctor about this. We had a conversation earlier on. But yes, in theory, we don't have as many restrictions on that. If it works, it works. The Me'iri takes this one stage further. Look at number 12. If what you're doing is a natural activity, like IVF in a lab, he's not talking about IVF, or there is Z into it, that's never going to be witchcraft if you're working in a laboratory. Even if you know how to produce new life without regular sexual reproduction, even if you can do that, that's okay. I don't know what he was thinking of at the time in Provence in the 1300s. I'm making a golem or so. I don't know what he's doing here. People know how to do this. That's not prohibited to do. If it's natural, it can't possibly be prohibited in witchcraft. That's like refuah. There's no problem. He takes it further, not just refuah. It's not refuah to create a new human being. That's not refuah, but it's natural. And if it's natural, he's saying what that Gemara means is if it's natural, it's not a problem. If you can do it in a lab, it's not a problem at all. So that's one issue, and therefore I don't think we need to be worried about drawing a line of being natural or unnatural. And we have to be careful about how using these words, unnatural, natural, what exactly does that mean? Again, Christian theologians tend to use these words more than we do, but here, certainly, it's not going to be a problem. Similarly, kilayim, I'm going to go a little bit faster because I've got a lot to do here, kilayim is also a problem. We're intervening even naturally in a way which is halakhically prohibited. So the Meiri will say, okay, so on those few things which are technically kilayim, that you can't do, the Torah says. I don't know why you can't do that. But other things, you don't have to create new boundaries of kilayim. Maybe let's look at number 14. Let's look at Rav Kook. Says Rav Kook, Hateva hu meshubach ma'on. Nature is amazing. Bimkomo haroiloi. When it's in the place it's meant to be. Ukeshehamalachuti ut, which must have more syllables than most words, when you end up manufacturing things, synthesizing things, nichneset b'makom ha'teva, when that introduces itself into nature, he mekalkelet oto. You can actually upset nature. He's taking a less interventionist approach. V'hine afal pi she'Hashem yisparach bara yisa'olam la'asot v'shelashlachlel etaken. Even though God created the world in a way which you're meant to improve it, you're meant to perfect it. Mikol makom sarich ha'adam is rizut, zirut, sorry. You have to be very careful, zirut yatera la'ayen. You have to check. She'rak yishachlel, okay, etateva, shehi matana. You must be careful not to cross the line between improving and destroying. Where that line is, he doesn't say, but you have to be careful with that. When you actually destroy what nature is meant to be doing, and you make something yourself which destroys that, as hu gomel and ashora. That's bad, like we saw in the Ksav of Kabbalah. That's spiritually very negative. Al kain higbila hatorah et yicholet ha'adam b'shinoi hadvarim. So therefore, the Torah put limits on what we can do with dvarim ativiyim, even in natural terms. Va'amra, and it says, behem techa lo tarah b'kilayim, don't crossbreed animals. Gets that in a minute. Sadchalot is rakilaim. Don't mix seeds in your field. Begid kilaim shatnas lo yalecha. Don't wear shatnas in your clothing. Lo sizra karma chakilaim. Do not sow in your vineyard different kilaim of seeds. V'kol zela hashrish b'leiv ha'adam. And that's not just specific examples. This is to place deep in the minds of a person etachiyuv lizaher, the obligation to be very careful. Shelol ares et hatever, not to cross that line. So, yes, we will intervene. Yes, we will do whatever is mutter, but we have to be careful that we're not in any way undermining. We'll see at the end of the shir, Rav Avram Steinberg is going to give us some practical guidelines. At the moment, it's a little bit up in the air, but we're going to see these guidelines. Chazal themselves speak with different voices on this. Look in number 15. Gemara Pesachim. The Tanya Rabbi Yosef Omer. Shnei dvarim alu b'machshava libaro be'erev Shabbos. There are two things that God... It occurred to God theoretically, potentially, to create. This means that they existed in potentia, but had not yet come into actuality. The line Ivru ad Motzei Shabbos, but they weren't created till Motzei Shabbos. Ube Motzei Shabbos, Natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Deya Ba'adam HaRishon, okay, Mein Dug Meshel Mala. God placed into man's mind the creative spirit of God Himself, to be able to do these things. What are they? He brought two stones together and pushed them against each other, the Yatzaman or and created fire. And he took two animals and he crossbred them and he made a mule. And that's good. No, that's not bad. This is like the creation of fire. Rabbi Sachs Zatzal compares this medrash with the myth of Prometheus. The Greek idea that really man was wrong to steal technology. Man had to invade the gods, steal fire from the gods. It builds up this kind of, there's an unnatural element to technology. This man would just say, no, God, man didn't steal fire from God. God gave man the ability to create this technology, and it's good. And don't forget, there's no reason why a non-Jew can't crossbreed animals. It's a mitzvah for Jews, not a mitzvah for non-Jews. So that's one voice within Chazal, which is great that Adam was able to do these things. And as I say, that's why we light a fire on Motzei Shabbos. However, there is a warning, even in the non-Jewish world. Remember at the end of Parshas Vayishlach, there's the whole, the generations of Seir, and all the kings of Edom. So in there's this unusual pasuk number 16, the Eile B'nei Tzivon, These are the children of Sivon, the Aya, the Ana. Don't worry about the Vavs, Rashi talks about them. His children were Aya and Ana, which is interesting because elsewhere it says that Ana was his brother, not his son, from which Rashi says, well, it was both because he slept with his mother and he had a son that was really his brother. Okay, not for now, but it's important. Who Ana? Why are we interested in this guy Ana? I've never heard of anyone calling their son Anna. I mean, it's not a Jewish name, and it would be a bit confusing. But Anna, this guy Anna, Asher Matza et Yemin Bamidbar, he discovered Yemin in the desert. Okay? Bamidbar Biroisa es Achamorim Litzivon Aviv, when he was pasturing his father's donkeys, if you pasture donkeys, whatever you do with donkeys, herding them. He discovered the Yemin. What's going on? Why is the Torah telling us this side? You could really miss this in a blink in the laning. He discovers these Yemins. Go over the page. Look at the Yerushalmi, number 17. Ha'esh v'hakilayim, fire and crossbred animals. This is the Talmud Yerushalmi's answer to the Talmud Bavli that we saw just before, which was great. Adam created these things. Even those things weren't created, they came into potential in the world of creation. Hakilayim. Now it's focused on kilayim. What are these yamim? Says the Yerushalmi. Chatzav sus v'chatzav chamor. Crossbreeds between a horse and a donkey. Ma'asat Sivon v'Ana, what did they do? These two farmers, herders. Zimen chamura, they took a female donkey, v'alav sus, and they brought a male horse, susachar, v'yatze mehem prida, and they produced a mule. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu lahem, God says to them, atem heveitim la'olam davar shehu meziko. You've brought something into the world that will damage the world. This mule, the Gemara here says, is very vicious. And this mule will cause a lot of damage. Af ani maybe al oisa ha'ish, I'm going to bring on you davashehu maziko, something which damages you as well. Midah keneged midah. Ma'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, zimin chachina, he brought a female snake, v'hela alav charadon, and he brought a male toad, v'yatsa mimenu chavarvar. I don't know how to pronounce that exactly. And they produced a highly poisonous lizard. End of quote. Not such a well-known medrash, but a very interesting medrash. It doesn't sound like such a great thing that they're doing here, crossbreeding animals and creating mules. It sounds like God saying to them, you're destroying the planet. What are you doing here? What are you thinking? I made horses and donkeys for a reason, not mules. If I'd have wanted mules, I'd have made mules. So here you see also this break. This, on the one hand, there's this push, yes, intervene, create the world and perfect the world, fill the world. On the other hand, there's this kind of, hey, this can end up in a very dangerous place if you're not very careful. It could be, Rav Dessler suggests, for example, that it's because Anna himself came from such a negative spiritual source. He himself was the offspring of his father and his sister, etc., etc., and therefore it could be that he himself was the wrong person to do that. It may depend on you. Only someone with strong spiritual roots can create a positive spiritual thing. I don't know. Rav Dessa suggests that there's a whole incest background going on here. Then there's also the idea that children are not created by people alone. You don't create children in a lab. Okay, number 18. Tan Rabban. Shloisha Shutzim Yesh Ba'adam. There are three contributors to a human being. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Aviv, the Imai. Aviv Mazri Haloven, the male, the father, gives all the white, quotes and quotes. Shemimeno Ad Samot, the bones, the gidin, the sinews, Sipranayim, the nails. Moyach Sheberosha, the white matter in the brain. The Loven Sheberei, the eye, and the white in the eye. Imoi Mazrat, Oidem, the mother gives the red. Shemimeno Or, the skin, Ubasar. The saros and the hair and the flesh, etc. The shachor sheba'ayin and the black in the eye. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, noisim, but ruach v'neshama. God gives the spirit, the soul to the person, klas depanim, the uniqueness of the face, ri'iyat ha'ayin, and the higher functions, sight, shmias ha'ayin, hearing, dibur peh, speech, v'haloch raglayim, movement, ubina v'haskel, and thought. You can't produce a human being without all three. And if you try, you will produce a subhuman being. That's also what's coming out of that. Again, it's not giving clear lines, but it's saying there is a danger. Be very, very careful. By the way, there's a Marasha that says when Lavan says to Yaakov, Atzamiu basariata, you are from my etzem and my basar. This Gemara is hinting to that. He's saying you're related to me on my mother's side, who gives the basar, and you're related to me on my father's side, who gives the atzamot. He brings out of this interesting medrash a pshat, or not a pshat, but an understanding of the chumash. You have to have shas on your fingertips to bring all these things out. But this is also an idea of kind of just wait, don't go too quickly. Now let's look at a bit of halacha. What is the halachic status of an unimplanted embryo? So we said last week, and I pick up again number 19. Even a fetus within the mother, in the uterus, until 40 days, is maya ba'alma, is a fluid. It doesn't have a status as a human life in the way we'll have later on in embryonic development. Now again, it's not a zero. It doesn't mean you can just delete it at will. There may be a potential life issue going on here, but certainly it is on a lesser level than a fetus later. Similarly, we said that the prohibition on abortion for a non-Jew is learned from a pasuk in Noach, number 20. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Someone who spills the blood of an Adam ba'adam, his blood will be spilt. And the Gemara says, Ezu Adam Shevu Ba'adam. What is a person in a person? Again, putting the comma in a different place, like we said last week. The prohibition on a non-Jew to abort a fetus is a fetus inside its mother. An Adam Shev Ba'adam. When we're dealing with genetic screening here, pre-implantation genetic screening, we're dealing with fertilized eggs in small embryos in a petri dish, in a lab. Nothing is inside the mother by definition. We're going to implant them later. And therefore, Rav Chaim David Alevi was asked to Shaila, have a look at this. This is a source that we haven't looked at ever before. Number 21. The Hine, Kvodor Kotev, he was a Rav Halevi, was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv for many years. He writes a tshuva, he says, you've written to me in your question, Shebebeit HaKolim HaNimtza Ba'echat HaShchunot HaMerkezet LiYudim Charedim B'New York. There's a hospital in one of the Haredi areas of New York. So those people here from Brooklyn and Queens can work out where this is. I don't know. Okay. Yoshev Rosh Befoil B'machleket L'Poriyat Aisha. And the person who wrote this question, is the head of the IVF department, of the fertilization department. Okay. Atem Oskim B'Hafrayat Mifchana. You are constantly involved in IVF, in vitro fertilization. You've obviously accepted views that you're allowed to do IVF, which is a mainstream halachic view. I want to answer your question now. This is the answer to your question, which is, what is the status of a fertilized embryo in the petri dish? Any fetuses, any of these fertilized eggs which you get rid of, which you terminate when they're in the lab, Ein aleihem klal ve'ikad din uba. They have absolutely no halachic status as a fetus. None at all. They're not implanted. The ein mechalin aleihem es haShabbos. Interesting practical outcome. We are allowed to, even mandated, to break Shabbos in order to save an embryo. But not to save a petri dish. Not to say fertilized eggs in a petri dish. Let's say, I don't know, the electricity goes off and we have to suddenly be Machal Shabbos to stop all of these embryos from defrosting or melting or whatever it is. That you're not allowed to do. Umutar lezarkan, you're allowed to throw them. Im lo nivcharu lashdala, if they are not chosen for implantation. Mishum she'ein din hapala ele mirechem isha dafka. Because the whole concept of a birth, of a fetus, is only from inside the body of a woman. That is true of Jews. And that's true of non-Jews as well. Even though with a non-Jewish world we're more strict on abortion, these shirim build on each other, we saw this last week. Maybe even within 40 days. That was something actually the Rav Chaim Oza last week said, maybe not. But he's saying we're even strict, you're not allowed to abort within 40 days if for a non-Jew. But if you're in a lab, there's no prohibition at all. And most poskim follow this psak, and certainly, as far as I'm aware, Machon Pua follows this psak, which is that there is no halakhic problem discarding the embryos which have been created in the lab before they have been implanted. It doesn't come into the sugya, into the discussion of abortion, really, at all.
Usually, in uterine practice, done after implantation?
No. There are other things they do after implantation. Sometimes...
Good.
So you're asking another thing, which is, what about when we've implanted a number of fetuses, a number of embryos, and then we have to remove two or three in order to enable the other ones to that's a different shit. That's a different Shiloh as well, because there we're actually actively terminating an embryo in order to save another embryo. Okay, that's a different thing, or a fetus at that stage. And like we said last week, you can terminate a fetus to save the mother, because the mother is, quote-unquote, more alive than the fetus. But can you terminate a fetus to save another fetus? Or do you say, whose blood is redder, this fetus or that fetus? That's another issue, which is not for now. Let's talk a little bit, not so many sources left, but there's three important new ones at the end. Let's talk about the actual technology, what people do. Page number 7. I'm not going to read all of this through. You can read it to yourself. But pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, as I said, is undertaken IVF. There are a couple, let's say, that have there's a danger with Tay-Sachs, for example. Certain babies will have, if the mother and the father are both carriers, there are certain babies that will have Tay-Sachs, but other babies will not. It doesn't mean that every baby will. So maybe you could do IVF. And then you could screen them, and you could look and diagnose which do and which don't. Most poskim are against elective PGD, meaning I don't have a medical reason. Tay-Sachs is obviously a medical reason. Tay-Sachs would be concerned that they don't want to have a Tay-Sachs child. But someone who just wants to do it for, to produce this kind of child or select this gender or that gender, many poskim are more concerned about that. I brought you a reference here at the bottom to Rav Shlomo Amar, who said that for genetic reasons it's okay, for pru revu it's okay, you want to have a boy or a girl, we'll talk about that soon, and for shalom bias it's okay. That's an interesting question. What does shalom bias mean? That may be something you've been pondering over many years of marriage, okay? But what does shalom bias mean? What are the lines in which he says? No, but he says explicitly, and I've brought you a reference in the sheets to the letters that Pua have showing the Rav Amar's responses. These are all responses that were given, we'll see soon, Rav Neuwirth, to Rav Menachem Bornstein, who is the head of Machon Pua, who wrote shilas to many different gedolim. Machon Pua are very careful to ask the shilas across a range of different gedolim, and they publish the responses and how the different gedolim paskin on that. Okay, fine. Genetic defects, which is a legitimate reason for PGD, what does that mean? So I brought Tay-Sachs is obvious. Down syndrome is obvious. What about cases which are less clear? What about, like I said before, things that may develop later in life? There's a child that may have a predisposition towards breast cancer later in life because he carries the BRCA gene. Is that a reason to not implant that child? What happened to Bitachon? What happened to Shomer Pesayim Hashem? The Gemara says in a number of cases, if you're doing something which is a normal risk taken by normal people and there's no reason to specifically think it's going to be actually dangerous, maybe the person will develop cancer, maybe they won't. Maybe this person will find a cure for cancer. And yet, you don't want to bring them into the world. How does that work? Not so straightforward that is refuah at all. What happens if two deaf people want a child who's deaf? Because then they'll be able to, associate and connect and communicate with that. Are you allowed to do that? Is that permitted, halakhically, to bring into the world a child which will have a quote-unquote disability? They may say it's not a disability. We just have alternative abilities. What about loisamol adam riecha? You're not allowed to stand by while somebody else is hurting. Does that mean you're not allowed to bring into the world a child that will suffer in some way? How does that work? No clear answer on this. We talked about the issues of dwarfism before. Can two people with dwarfism produce a child who also has that, or is that not fair on the child? Dor Yesharim, of course, is a screening process that don't actually tell you what's wrong, partly for these reasons. Dor Yesharim is set up in a way that all they tell you is if you're a good match or a bad match. But you'll never find out what actually the problem is. There are other systems that do tell you what the problem is, because Dor Yesharim was set up long ago before you could actually fix any of the problems. And that's an interesting question, Dor Yesharim. Now that there is the ability to correct some of these genetic issues, should it be changed to something that will give people the information? On the other hand, information is sometimes very unhelpful. If you have information, that might affect your shidduch chances, certainly in certain communities, in ways that you would rather not know. But that's not a conversation for another time. What about eradicating sickness? Maybe we'll, like any time we take away, they're talking about taking genetically modifying all of the mosquitoes that carry malaria. So the mosquitoes will not be able to carry malaria anymore. So think how many millions of people will be saved. But on the other hand, what's going to happen that we didn't anticipate when we take away the malaria mosquitoes, we're going to work out potentially there's something else that needed those mosquitoes, and now we have no X, Y, Z. Again, that's not a reason not to cure people with malaria, but it's a danger. It's for sure a danger. And what about boys or girls? Let me give you some scenarios. Look at page 8, but this will finish in the next three or four minutes. What if the person wants a boy or a girl? Why would they want a boy or a girl? Well, maybe they like boys or they like girls. That's not a good reason. Maybe they have a good reason. Let's say the father is a Cohen and he's not fertile, and they want to use artificial insemination by donor, which is permitted in certain situations, but the child won't be a Cohen. So the family says, so let's have a girl, not a boy, because if we have a boy, then everyone's going to call him up Cohen and he'll say, well, I'm not really a Cohen. Why are you not Cohen? Your dad's a Cohen. Sounds like the beginning of a bad joke, but it's not a joke, because he's going to say, well, he's not really my dad. I was produced by artificial insemination. We don't want to have that conversation in shul on Shabbos morning, so maybe they want to have a girl. What happens if they follow up Psak, that if they're not if the father's not halakhically related biologically to the child, then they have a problem of Shmirat Negiah or Yichud. So the father says, well, let's have a boy, because then I won't have this issue, otherwise it's going to be difficult. I'm not getting into that now. Many poskim are lenient on that issue. What happens if there is, I brought you the case in the notes, there was a family with severe depression, because the father had only the same gender child, and they needed, it doesn't actually say which gender it was. He had a lot, five boys, or he had five girls. Depending on the family, that could work in either direction. But either way, this father was particularly depressed and couldn't function as a father anymore without the other gender child. And they got upset that they couldn't choose the gender based on that, and the family was, if you like, rehabilitated. What if a person has lots and lots of boys and they want to do pruravu? At what point can they select an embryo to do that? Rav Yosef said, after 6 children of the same sex, then you can talk to me, he said. And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said after 5. Okay, fine.
I have 5 sons, she has 5 sons.
6.
Okay, excuse me. Okay, fine. But you had a daughter in the end? Okay, well, now you know what to ask. Okay, fine. Let's just finish in the last 2 minutes of the shiur. I brought you 3 new sources here. Number 22 is Rav Steinberg. Rav Steinberg sets out the test and says, this is how I will guide you. You have to ask 3 questions. Number 1, is what you're about to do halakhically permitted? If not, then you don't get off base 1. Number 2, does it have any secondary consequences that you can't avoid, which are halakhically problematic? And number 3, is there an overall human benefit to the activity? Very difficult to assess that, but he says you have to ask that. And finally, number 23, the Gemara, famous Gemara, Amarava, Bashashim, Achnisim, Adam Ledin, Omrim Loi, when you go to Shamayim, they'll ask you a number of questions. Nasatava natata be'emunim, were you honest in business? Kavata itim latoro, did you set aside time to learn Torah? Asakta b'piria rivia, did you try to do pruravu? That's the question. Not did you do pruravu. Not kiyamta priya rivia. But asakta, did you do what you could? And if you can't, then you can't. That's not your obligation. Anista rachmana patra, we can't do what we can't do. And sometimes priya rivia is something that people try and they can't succeed. The question is, how hard do you have to try to have tried? Maybe, well, you could have tried because you could have done pre-implantation genetic screening, and that would have been trying harder. So that's a question. I brought you with the end of Neuwirth. Rav Neuwirth was asked this question by Pua, and he was very unhappy, actually. Look at what he says. He said, Sarli, I'm actually quite upset that you're even involving yourself in these issues. He wrote back to Pua, published a letter. I'm unhappy with all of this. Tafkidchem la'azor la'anashim b'inyanei ishut. Your job is to help people in ways which are, personal in that sense. V'loi b'inyanim ke'elo, not in trying to create, genetically modified embryos or screened embryos. V'ad anachnu tzuchim la'asot et shelanu. We only have to do what we can do. V'ashar b'dei Kodesh Baruch Hu. Everything else is in the hands of Shamayim. And then he refers him to a tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman about sperm selection, which implies that, actually, I think it is okay for certain things. In that case, it was to prevent hemophilia, and they wanted to try and get out the male carrying sperm, the X's, and only use the X's, whatever. So he is leaving the door open a little bit to something, but he again puts the brakes on here and says, I'm a little bit upset that you're even involved in this. So what's the answer? That's not my job to give you answers. ask a Shaila. But we push in different directions on this, but these are many of the sources that deal with this issue. In principle, most poskim permit this for certain reasons, and Baruch Hashem, it's helped many parents to have healthy children. Long may that continue. Next week, we finish off our embryology, and we move into Pastures New, which I've not yet decided on. Someone actually asked me to give a share on why this year's calendar is so strange. And I thought that actually might be in terms of the Parshas and why we're out of sync with Chutz La'aretz for weeks and weeks, months and months and months. And actually, we've never looked into the Jewish calendar, and I think we should do at least one share on that. That would be fascinating. But we'll do other things as well. I'm open to suggestions, but I wish you a great week. See you next week, please God.